Welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Most of our discussions on politics, economics, and culture are now also available to watch on our YouTube channel. This week, the podcast is out on Monday, but the discussions took place last week. Having been threatened during the debate over the national insurance increase, Boris Johnson's cabinet reshuffle is a subject on everybody's minds. Ian Martin, Maggie Pagano, and Tim Montgomery discussed who's out and who's in, and what the future holds for Boris Johnson's cabinet.
Tim, give us the main highlights and headlines, and how does it look to you?
Well, I think it's a reward. In a previous incarnation, Ian, I set up a poll at Conservative Home in conjunction with YouGov that rated the cabinet, although it was actually the shadow cabinet then, as to how they were doing in the eyes of Tory activists. I'm quite proud of setting up this little poll. And actually, if you look at who's been promoted, they're people at the top of the poll, and who's been demoted are people at the bottom of the poll. Now, more seriously, what that might suggest, and I just discussed this with Evan Davis on the PM programme, is that people, politicians, ministers who do what Tory activists like seem to be preferred by the Prime Minister, and those who upset Tory activists and the Tory base have been demoted. And that brings me perhaps to my main point about this reshuffle. My main disappointment is it's not a restoration of the big tent Conservative Party. We aren't seeing some of the big beasts who back Remain or have taken a different position from the Prime Minister on COVID brought back into government. And it wasn't an especially strong, competent government beforehand. And I'm not really convinced that in the kind of appointments that have been made today, the Prime Minister has really addressed that. Maybe there'll be more on the junior ministerial level. But one really upside, apart from my personal delight at Nadine and Nadim, I'm going to have to improve my enunciation, being given good jobs, they're good friends. I think Michael Gove taking over the housing brief is a big deal. There is no future for the Conservative Party if it doesn't help young people get on the housing ladder. Michael Gove is not everyone's favourite politician, but he's an extraordinary thinker. I think this is a sign that the Tories might be more serious about house building, affordable housing, than the Conservatives have been up until this point. So that, for me, is the most promising part of this still unfolding reshuffling of Boris's back.
Really interesting, Tim. It's, of course, and you mentioned that poll which you set up on Conholme. That's always been one of the main political measures since it was launched that I track. And politicians are, and particularly members of the cabinet, who pay really close attention to that poll. Always like to say, well, it's self-selecting, but they always know the movements in it. And it also turns out to be a really good guide ahead of a leadership contest, or as you said, a reshuffle, or anything significant happening in Conservative politics. You know, it's very reliable. Though I noticed that Boris Johnson, you said people who are really popular in the poll are being rewarded. So Boris Johnson hasn't been doing very well in that poll. Yeah. In the last few editions of it, he's been really low down. But then he's the Prime Minister, so he gets to do what he likes for the moment.
I think it would be unlikely that he would sack himself. But I'm surprised
anything can happen.
I'm surprised he's chopped Gavin Williamson, actually. I'm delighted that he has. I thought he might move into leader of the House or something. But because, what's that Lyndon Johnson maxim about, people pissing from outside of the tent, excuse my French. And it'll be interesting to see what Gavin Williamson does from the back benches.
Yeah, there was a rumour, wasn't there, Maggie, earlier on reshuffle day that Gavin Williamson, now being removed as Education Secretary, that he was going to go to Northern Ireland, where he has a close relationship with the DUP. Though, of course, Northern Irish politics is changing, and actually it's a good relationship with the UUP, who are rising, the more moderate unionist party. Anyway, that's by the by. What do you make, Maggie, of some of the big moves? What catches your eye?
Well, the word I'd written down here on my notepad right at the top was reward. Completely saw it as Tim has seen it. And I think he was very brave, actually, to appoint Liz Truss, because she really has done a phenomenal job at trade and doing all the deals, rolling them over with the EU. She annoys a lot of people, but she does really appeal to the activists. And also she has a real energy and optimism about her, which I think at this moment in time, as you go overseas and Britain establishes relationships and so forth, is really good. People have seen Dom Raab as a demotion, but actually I think it's quite a clever appointment, because he really, when Boris was ill last year, he was clearly a very good deputy PM. I mean, all the reports you heard from cabinet were that, you know, he stuck to the detail, was quite thorough. So it is a demotion, but
it was sad
to see Buckland go. I've always rather liked Robert Buckland, who's a very soft, gentle man. I hope he can find another role for him. I don't think.
But there's something quintessentially British and farcical about being demoted to deputy prime minister. I'm not sure. I mean, we'll see in the next day or so what emerges about those conversations between Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab, because they took longer than expected. So something, whether he was forced or felt compelled to make him deputy prime minister as well, because he essentially...
I just come from listening to the radio, and I can't remember, I think it might have been Laura Kunzberg, but the suggestion is that it wasn't deputy PM position wasn't offered to Dominic Raab, but ended up that he got it during that, as you say, in extended discussion. So it might not have been the prime minister's intention, but anyway, he gave it to him one way or the other to pacify him.
Yeah, it's a curious thing.
There was a lot of criticism last year, wasn't there? And there were calls from all sides that actually what the cabinet needed was a relatively strong deputy, rather like May had, you know, and to put it in name too.
I think the picture from that period, Maggie, is really mixed. It depends who you listen to. Cummings has a particular view on that period in the COVID crisis where Boris was incapacitated. I mean, what they didn't really want, or what Team Boris didn't really want, was Michael Gove. I remember at the time someone saying, you know, if Michael takes over, then he'll never hand control back to Boris, and would be, you know, hyperactive and hyper efficient. So they saw Raab as a more transactional figure who wouldn't necessarily threaten Boris's position politically. But then, in his defence, I've heard people say that he did seem to transact business in a relatively efficient way in that difficult period. But then, having been Foreign Secretary, he was also had a very poor Afghan crisis, demoted, and has then clearly argued his corner and negotiated quite successfully with Boris Johnson, who doesn't really like confrontation. The consequence, as you said, is that Robert Buckland, who was seen as a really good performer and a really good operator, finds himself evicted and cabinet career over. So that's a bit of a surprise. The other thing that I would flag up would be Dowden to party chair. Now, the party
chairman, chairman, Ian, the Tories still insist on calling them chairman.
So the party chairman,
even Saeed Abbasi,
Amanda Miller, co-chair, is gone. And it's that's a really interesting move, which reflects the reality that they're clearly very stung by the reporting about what's going on at CCHQ, and the way in which the previous setup with a co-party chair, Ben Elliott and Amanda Milling, not a political big hitter, meant that there wasn't a proper balance. That person, as Tory donors have been saying, the people who are actually who pay for Tory HQ, have been saying, that person has to be a politician. That has to be someone who's either elected or in the House of Lords, who's a politician rather than a fundraiser. So I think Dowden is very good on broadcast for them, and I think will be put in there to try and bring some operational and institutional coherence to CCHQ, which, I mean, there are some people who work at CCHQ will tell you that it's already been reorganized and it's actually operating fairly smoothly. I don't know, but they've put him in to clean things up, if you like. So that's the other thing that I would flag up. Just going down the list, obviously.
Can I disagree with a couple of things that Maggie said? If I may be so bold, I'm doing it with a suitable geographical distance between us in case
Maggie
lashes out at me. I should say I really agree about Robert Buckland. I thought he was a good, solid cabinet minister. And he was also part of, you know, the big tent conservatism I still would love to see post-Brexit. You know, he's sort of what Margaret Thatcher probably would have called a wet. But, you know, he's part of the One Nation tradition, a Remain supporter. And he's one of the few people in the cabinet who was part of that breadth. And to lose him, I think, is a real shame and a slightly dangerous signal, actually. But where I would mildly, I think, disagree with you, Maggie, is I'm a bit worried about the Liz Truss appointment. I think she is definitely strikes strong positions. Mm. Her reputation, though, across lots of Whitehall is that she doesn't really get into the detail on stuff. Mm. And I don't actually think the Australia trade deal was that good. And I don't think she was particularly brilliant chief secretary when she worked with Philip Hammond. And I worry a little bit about that. And if you tie that with Priti Patel being kept in place, it does suggest that two of the greatest offices of state are really held by people that Boris wants there for political communication reasons rather than anything else. Maybe Priti Patel might yet lose borders from her Home Office brief. I think that would be a sensible way of lightening the load on her. But perhaps it's a sign that actually, compared to education and health, you know, which aren't traditional big offices, but they're probably going to be absolutely central to Conservative fortunes and the country's fortunes over the next 2 years. And so Sajid Javid and Nadeem Zahawi there, Boris has put two of his most able ministers in those public-facing jobs where the huge backlog challenges will probably determine the course of this parliament more than foreign policy or home affairs policy.
Richard Tice is a businessman and former member of the European Parliament. He is now the leader of Reform UK. Tim Montgomery spoke to him about the future of the Conservative Party, taxes and all things Nigel Farage. Here's a snippet from their conversation. To listen to the whole thing, go to our YouTube channel.
What do you see as the Reform Party's mission? Because you obviously have inherited the Brexit Party identity. You've still got the same colour and the same graphics, but you've lost Nigel Farage. I think he's... What's his relationship with you now? Is he a member?
So Nigel's honorary president.
Yeah.
And so he gives me some useful tips in my ear. He's a very useful sounding board. But as you know, he's got his own high-profile media career that he's pursuing very successfully.
Yeah. And you're the leader. Who else, perhaps, that people might recognise is involved in your party?
So I'm the leader, and then I've got a deputy leader who is Dr. David Bull, who was an MEP for the Brexit Party. Yeah. He was a medical doctor, worked in A&E for many years, then was on TV, so he's well known. Our leader in Scotland is Michelle Ballantyne. She previously was a Conservative MSP. And so, yeah, we've got and essentially we're growing, and it's a bit like we're hoping... from a small acorn to grow into a mighty oak, Tim. That's the analogy. That's the plan.
And a lot of those, because I remember David Bull when he was on the Conservative candidates list in years past. You sound like you're quite a conservative, at least in terms of backgrounds, quite a conservative orientated party. Is that fair?
Well, look, I think we have sort of the same similar principles, similar values, insofar as we believe in individual responsibility. We believe in a small state. But then things have, in a sense, shifted. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but the Conservative Party moved away from us. And I now call them the Consocialists, not the Conservatives.
Yeah.
Because they've now become the party of high taxation, high regulation. And that leads, in like night follows day, that leads to low growth. And it leads to big state. And that's a disastrous prospect for the UK. It's previously been rejected, and it's not what they were elected to do. So, you know, we feel that there is a, they've moved, essentially, that you can't really put a cigarette paper between them and the Labour Party now. There's a huge gap in the where Conservatives traditionally sat, you know, which is in a high growth, low taxation, smart regulation environment, because that's the only way you can get higher wages. It's the only way you get higher tax revenues to invest in much more efficient reformed public services.
I have a lot of sympathy with what you've just said. And I've always been a Conservative who believes that, you know, the kind of reforms that Margaret Thatcher brought through in the 1980s, cutting tax, cutting regulation, explain the British Renaissance, really. We were the sick man of Europe, and we became one of Europe's strongest economies. My concern from sort of an electoral positioning for your point of view is actually a lot of the reforms that Margaret Thatcher made weren't popular at the time. People liked their benefits. They liked their state services. And actually, the tax cuts, the economic reforms, the privatizations, they worked, but actually they were carried, the popularity of the Thatcher government, so much more, for example, to the, you know, the Falkland Islands campaign or tough approach to law and order, etc. So how do you, as an insurgent,
well, I'm going to slightly challenge that, Tim.
Take me on.
Margaret Thatcher was popular because she made people wealthier. She made people more prosperous. Earnings went up. Growth went up. And actually, it was some of the most dispossessed people who occupied council houses. They actually benefited, arguably, amongst the most because they were able to buy their council houses. They did very well out of that. That put them on, a growth profile. People did well out of Mrs. Thatcher. She rewarded hard work, and the vast majority of people in this country, I think, saw that. And I think that's the danger of high taxation. If you tax people too highly,
Richard, I'm going to push back on you now because I'm not disagreeing with any of that. Absolutely, she made people wealthier, and she worried about the lower middle class voters. You know, she wasn't just interested in a party of the rich, but it was more the fruits of her policies rather than the policies themselves that were popular. I think part of your challenge is to convince the sort of people that voted for the Brexit Party, who Seb Payne, who's just written from the Financial Times, has just written a book on Labour's broken heartland. His argument is actually they're quite sympathetic to some of the bigger spending policies of this Consocialist government. How do you respond to that? Do you disagree with that analysis?
So I think what people want is smart spending, mm-hmm. and people want efficient public services that work. So our economic vision is very clear. I want to take 6 million of the lowest earners out of paying any income tax by lifting the threshold from 12.5 grand to 20 grand. The Tories want to bring 1 million more of the lowest paid into paying income tax. Unbelievable. I want to take 1 million businesses out of paying any corporation tax by lifting the threshold from 0 to 100 grand a year. That way you get the money will circulate through the economy more. Business people and its individuals will always spend a pound in their pocket better with more value than a civil servant spending it on their behalf.
Last week saw Andrew Neil leave GB News. Maggie and Tim discussed the future of the channel and why Andrew might have felt like leaving.
So, Tim, a couple of weeks ago, maybe longer, we first started talking about GB News. And if you remember, we gave, in our very humble opinion, a few pointers. And I think we both predicted that within 2 to 3 months it would get much better. And it obviously has. And just as it's doing rather well, we had the bombshell. Well, it was fairly widely leaked bombshell that Andrew Neil, who started it, he was the founder, he was the inspiration, is leaving. What impact do you think that's going to have on the channel?
Well, you say it's a bombshell, and then you said perhaps it wasn't, Maggie, and I think that's right in a way. I think you know, it's been an odd setup for a while. Andrew Neil was there for the first 2 weeks of the channel. He was there on the opening night. He was the opening presenter. And then, of course, he disappeared. It's all been a bit odd. And none of us really quite know what happened. But clearly it wasn't a perfect fit for whatever reason. And I think it's just lots of people on Twitter have done the usual thing as people on Twitter do. Oh, this is really bad for the channel. It's in trouble. And just, you know, underlining some of the teething problems they had. But to be honest, is anyone really surprised that Andrew Neil has gone now? We were surprised at the beginning when it didn't work, but I mean, it hasn't been part of it for a while. He's going to continue as a contributor. I thought his contribution on Nigel Farage's programme last night on the relationship with China was, you know, it was really top telly between Nigel Farage and Andrew Neil, just talking about the far too close links between our university sector, between various parts of business, your realm, Maggie, and the British establishment. I think he's still going to contribute properly, I hope. But, you know, the trajectory of GB News was clear for a while that it wasn't dependent upon Andrew Neil, and I think that's going to continue now.
Yeah. What intrigued me was that nobody seemed to give an explanation on either side what the divergence of views was. Do we think it was going too right wing for Andrew, too populist? What was it we think he didn't like, or what was the row about? Or was it, as often in these cases, you know, the person who founds the business is often the person who, you know, walks away. It's classic business in a sense. And perhaps he just doesn't, you know, he's got a great life down the south of France. He's made money and so forth. He just didn't need the trouble of a teething news station. But in terms of the political views, I've still not got a grip on what the divergence was. It too much like a Fox News? I mean, you know Fox News very well, Tim.
So. Yeah. Well, look, I think what you just said previously, Maggie, is key to it. I think in some of these rows, you can never underestimate just that basic human factor. Both of us have been involved in startups in various kinds. Reaction is still, in some senses, a startup. You know, startups are incredibly hard work. And, you know, as you say, Andrew Neil lives in France. You know, he's been at the top of television and broadcasting journalism for a long time. And my theory, I don't know this for sure, is I just think part of his thinking was, you know, I've got a nice life with my, you know, the dogs he regularly tweets about. I just thought, did he want the hassle of having to put in the hard yards that a startup requires? And then you add it to what, you know, I think your other questions were leading to, this sort of suggestion that, you know, the technical problems, is it a little bit too populist rather than as substantial, for example, as the Spectator magazine, which he chairs? And I think those things, I think it was an accumulation of things. But my bigger picture thing that I think really matters, Maggie, is there's a lot of snooty stuff on Twitter and social media from the normal, you know, the usual suspects not liking GB News. I think actually it really matters. And I think it's going to be a huge force in British politics. When I did the Nigel Farage Talking Pints thing last week, as we discussed on Press Review, I was incredibly struck by just the number of Conservative MPs, Conservative commentators, Conservative activists that I know contacted me afterwards. It may not be watched by a huge number of people yet, but like Fox News in the States, it's being watched by a key demographic. It's being watched by the Conservative movement, if you like. And I think if they get it right, this channel will be a huge preaching to the choir phenomenon. And preaching to the choir isn't a bad thing if you get the choir to sing more sweetly, you know, sing better songs, better hymns. And in the same way that Fox News has been a huge influence on the Republican movement in the USA, for good or ill. I'm impressed with what I see of the Angelos, the, I forget his Greek surname now, but the chief executive of the channel. He's an impressive individual, and he's not afraid to experiment and change You know, if something's not working, a program's not working, a presenter's not working, he's prepared to change it. I think this channel's going to succeed. I know a lot of the financial backers behind it. They're committed.
They like it, do they? They're pleased with how it's going?
I don't think they're... I think they're happy enough with the progress. I think they'd like to see a lot of the technical problems resolved. I think they know that it can't just be the Farage channel. The Farage hour is working well in terms of, you know, beating Sky and BBC, I think, most nights. I enjoy it, if I'm allowed to confess that. But there's not much else on the channel yet that I regard as must watch. And so that's what I think the donors and that have to create. They need to find other must watch slots. That it's working on YouTube. I don't think you can underestimate that. You compare the hits that GB News videos are getting compared to the hits that other TV channels are getting, and they're really up there. The YouTube game is strong. So don't discount this. The naysayers want this to fail. They're being very condescending about it. I think it's going to work. And I think for those of us who care about the conservative movement and sort of right-wing politics, it needs to work, because we need this internet TV presence in our entertainment world.
And indeed, Tim, from what you're suggesting, we need the debate. So you almost, what you're suggesting is it's activists, MPs who are liking it, but maybe it will become a place where they can actually discuss some of these ideas amongst themselves. Because in a sense, if you're going on Newsnight, you've got 5 minutes and it's always about defending your position, isn't it? But maybe here we're going to see some debate of conservative ideas, principles, like, let's say, national insurance tax. In a sense, that would be a classic area for them to expand, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what they need is, you know, I'm maybe not their typical viewer. Perhaps you're not either, Maggie, but...
Catholic in my taste.
Exactly. That's a good example, you see. I think they have done a little bit, you know, I know you didn't mean Catholic in this sense, but I think there's room for more sort of religious serious programming. I think there's room for bigger interviews of more thoughtful nature rather than some of the quicker hits that they have at the moment. I'd like to see Liam Halligan, for example, a mutual friend of ours. He's at the moment doing a business program every lunchtime. But I'd like to see him have a really serious program, you know, at least once a week, where we really get a different kind of economic view, talking to someone like yourself. And I think they could just be a little bit weightier in some of their segments. You know, Dan Wootton has 3 hours in the evening, one of our initial broadcasts on this, Maggie, was, you know, just have more 1 hour slots. 3 hours is too much for anyone, in my view.
Exhausting. In a sense, they've established, they've got the good popular, they got Farage and the other programs. Now they almost need to go down and a bit more, an hour debate with, I don't know, two religious people, somebody on housing, actually take housing, but not for 10 minutes, an hour, and have it thrashed through. So I'd like to see. There we go. You're talking about the Conservative Party. How do you think the government is doing? Obviously, today was quite a big day with Sajid Javid's statement on the winter. How do you feel they're managing to present this plan?
How long have you got, Maggie?
About 2 minutes.
Well, look, here's something I would say, and come back to me on me if you think I'm wrong. And perhaps we should discuss this at more length, because I know we don't have time today. But there's enormous focus on the NIA rise, which is fair enough. It's a big deal. And there's enormous focus on, you know, for example, the COVID passports row. Today, it's Sajid Javid rolling out booster jabs and the whole business of vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds. There is discussion about the universal credit uplift of £20. But nowhere near enough, in my view. I think if you're looking for something that really could cause the Conservative government enormous problems if they don't change their policy on, taking £20 a week away from 5.5 million households is a huge thing to do. And I think the government don't realise how much trouble they could be getting themselves into if they don't start to manage this policy a lot better. Look, the deficit problem is a real one. The backlogs in health, education, courts, etc. are huge. I'd hate to be in government at the moment. Sometimes I'm much grateful to be a pundit rather than a practitioner. But this is big deal politics. And so I think the government are maybe a little bit, well, not a little bit, far too blasé about having conquered previous difficulties that they can conquer this one easily too. I'm not so sure.
So agree. And I think Teresa Coffey, who's usually quite eloquent in her defence, sort of, she had a Marie Antoinette moment yesterday, didn't she, when she said, oh, well, these people only have to work 2 more hours a day, a week, whatever it was. That was a very foolish comment and has been rebuffed wholeheartedly by those that know. No, it is. It you can feel it, can't you, going into the winter. This you have families who £80 a month. Well, actually, Citizens Advice Bureau, I think, have already said, you know, it's going to put some people into debt. It's sort of unnecessary. I don't know the total cost of it, but you wait till Marcus Rashford gets hold of this and you can see a big campaign being stored up. Very foolish.
Marcus Rashford, the Saracen rugby player, do you mean, Maggie?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. He's the very one.
Yeah. No, well, we should, I think, at Reaction, we'll talk to our editor, Ian, about this, but I think there's a lot more that all of us should be doing about universal credit. So we should really do a proper session on it with some people who know what we're talking about.
Yeah. And see the precise numbers and how many it will affect and and what it would cost to resolve. I mean, it just seems insane when you've still got several million people on furlough in some way to be able to cut this at this moment. Foolish.
Yeah. This week, in the fifth episode of our new show Press Review, Ian, Tim and Maggie chose the stories in the media that grabbed them. From the AUKUS Defence Pact to the Norwegian election, here are the Reaction editors.
My first pick is Henry Olsen in the Washington Post, where he's essentially saying, and this is, we'll get to the UK reshuffle and British politics, I'm sure, at some point, but I think what's happened with this new defence deal between the US, Australia and the UK, AUKUS as it's being called, is a tectonic plates shifting moment in geopolitics. So much to talk about. But what fascinated me about it is, and I'm very interested in how how Americans are viewing the rest of us, is that Henry's piece essentially says this is a masterstroke by the US, that it reorganizes the West, outfoxes China, and should cheer everyone up who believes in Western values and the unity of the West. Now, I must confess, I have mixed feelings about this move. I think while it's tempting to see the way in which it's infuriated Maggie, the French, particularly. I mean, the French have cancelled various celebratory events that they had scheduled for this weekend with the US to celebrate the great US-French alliance. This decision, essentially meaning that Australia will have American nuclear-powered subs rather than buying from France, has infuriated France. And I think while there's a short-term, maybe even amusement factor in some of that, and particularly in Britain where the Brexit debate obviously colours everything, I think it's medium term and longer term, potentially quite worrying that it divides the West. Do you see it as, well, firstly, do you think, Maggie, that am I overstating how important this deal is, its significance? And do you think the French are right to be annoyed?
I don't think you're overstating it. Even the Chinese have named it the new Cold War. I mean, this was clearly a very direct, came from the Australians, apparently, Australians and Americans, and then to Britain, asked Britain specifically, Western surveillance in the Asia Pacific with submarines going up round the China Seas. I mean, it is quite an aggressive act in many ways. So no, it's a huge shift. And I think it has huge ramifications for NATO. As you just said, France is the second or third biggest spender in NATO, very close ally of Britain. So not only does it drive a wedge between US and France, but Britain and France, who always work traditionally very closely together. From what one hears, the French-US deal for the diesel-powered submarines was dead in the water anyway. That was, you know, that's sort of an old story. But the way they presented it, and I don't know if you guys watched the video that night, it was sort of, well, I wrote in a column this morning, it was sort of like a Bond movie where, you know, you had the three head leaders, you know, beamed in live. It's very funny, actually, Biden couldn't remember Morrison's name. You sort of expected Dr. Evil or Dr. No to come in and be beamed down and say, hey, guys, what are you doing? You're starting a new war. It was really weird. So I think presentation wasn't very clever.
And you
I
watch think, too many films, Maggie.
I do, really. But I think rather foolish and unnecessary to have alienated France like this. We do need France. I mean, what does it tell us about US relations with NATO? I don't know. But we had only this week Ursula von der Leyen talking about a new defence force for the EU. So you can sort of see, as you said, tectonic plates moving here.
What I thought was interesting, though, about Henry's piece in the Washington Post was that it makes a series of assumptions about American power and presents it as a masterstroke. Whereas, actually, I think, you know, it's possible to the West does need to reorganize and regenerate because of the threat from China. But and there's been a lot of conversation in the last couple of years. How do you what's the forum in which you do that? It really doesn't seem that it can be NATO, and it can't, despite what Macron wants, it can't be the EU, because the Brits are not going to sign up to be essentially under EU command. Though interestingly, Bruno Waterfield in the Times on Friday reports that the Dutch are making overtures, essentially trying to get Britain to take part in a conversation about European security and increased defence cooperation. So there's a problem, but there's a problem there. The Brits have very close working military working relationships with the French, but are not going to embed themselves. Boris Johnson is not going to embed himself in a European defence superstructure, which is overseen by effectively by the European Commission. I mean, Brexit means that that is not going to happen. So there's all of this swirling around, plus the idea that Boris Johnson had and you know, the influence of his foreign affairs advisor, John Bew, Attlee's biographer, the notion of a bigger Western alliance, something like a D10, which is going to be Five Eyes plus the intelligence partnership, plus France, Japan, certainly an increasingly critical power when it comes to organizing against China defensively. And with a question mark against India. But that now, in the context of this deal, where essentially which costs France tens of billions of euros to its defence industry and is regarded by the French as publicly humiliating. I mean, Henry says it's a masterstroke, but it doesn't look to me like it's not a Kissingerian brilliant piece of diplomacy when one of your main allies accuses you publicly, the French, accuses the Biden administration of stab in the back. The other story that I wanted to mention in that context, just to remind us all that Afghanistan has not gone away as a subject, is a really interesting story from a magazine called Newslines. Newslines magazine covers the Middle East in a very interesting way with long form essays. And there's a piece just published this week called The Drone Unit That Helped the Taliban Win the War. And we put on Press Review the links to these pieces which have grabbed us below the video, so you can read for yourself. But it's a really interesting report by one of their journalists, an Afghan journalist, and it details how the Taliban got their hands on some really sophisticated, interesting drones and used them in their campaign to take over the whole of Afghanistan, which has been portrayed in a lot of the Western media as, well, just these sort of hicks rolling in from the countryside and rolling into the urban areas and the army ran away. But it tells a really interesting story about where they got the kit from allegedly from inside China on the black market, and then how they use that to take out various anti-Taliban warlord commanders on the ground. So I heartily recommend that. Shall we move on to the reshuffle?
I've been focusing on the much more important who's up and who down inside the Tory party rather than the strategic stuff you've been looking at, Ian. But on the face of it, I think I share the concerns of you both. After the Afghanistan debacle, I think one of the key things that struck me was how dependent we are on America. And it seemed to me a good moment to pause and think, post-Brexit, does Britain need other options? You know, a lot of our technology, our military hardware, etc., is almost completely dependent upon operations with America. France, you know, has more independence of operation. And it did seem, and I'm a committed Brexiteer, haven't changed on that, but we should have options in the world. And, you know, being close to France bilaterally, the Europe's other military power, seemed a wise path for us to at least explore and to, you know, not even discuss with Paris what we were doing. It's just strikes me as amateurish. And so I love Henry. I regard him as a good friend, but masterstroke is not the word I would use to describe this. I worry that the West is very badly led at the moment. And this looks like more of a rush job to look like the West is, you know, on the ball post-Afghanistan. And I fear it, the reverse is true.
So I'm going to write in my reaction newsletter for reaction members this weekend, going out on Saturday morning. I'm going to write a bit more about this and about some of the background about how it's happened, how it came together, and some of the implications. I think I agree with you, Tim, on the French situation, where actually it's a process that began under Sarkozy and has continued under his successors. That incredible closeness on defence between Britain and France, where essentially in some respects we operate interwoven. You know, in operationally in every single aspect. You just look at the launch of the carriers and the operation that was assembled around that. That was done very much with France's help. Now, the problem in all of this, though, is I think it's President Macron. Whereas to just present it from, you look at it from the perspective for a second of London. For many months now, the Brits have been attempting to organise a proper summit involving Boris and Macron to discuss all manner of things, to which the French response has been essentially, no, there's nothing to discuss. They have just seen it as the Brits wanting special pleading on Brexit and Northern Ireland, whereas the Brits have been trying to say, no, the world is changing, there's all this other stuff at stake, shouldn't the Brits and the French at least meet properly and kind of see what comes out of it? And France has said no, partly because of Macron's view that Britain has made a historic mistake and that the solution to European security lies via the EU rather than purely bilateral stuff or stuff that involves the Americans. So Britain, London, has and Boris have tried, and essentially they haven't been welcomed with open arms. So I think we're just going to move on now to, I mentioned there, Boris Johnson, who's had a hell of a week. It's been reshuffle week in the UK. And Tim, tell us a bit about that. Your pick on this is from The Guardian, I think.
Yeah, I think generally in this press review, I think the idea is that we pick articles and features that people might enjoy and learn from. This, viewers, is not such an example. I think when I look back at my distinguished journalistic career, and there are so many great articles to choose from, of course, I think one of my favourite ones, Ian, you might remember, I wrote a review for The Times of one of Polly Toynbee's books.
Yes, I do remember that, yes.
But John Witherow, the editor, loved it. Basically, I read this book. It was on the Cameron years. Yeah, 300-400 pages. There was not one nice thing in that article about David Cameron or the Conservatives. In 400 or whatever pages, Polly Toynbee could not find even one thing to say positive about her political opponents. And Polly Toynbee is part of the problem in British politics. She probably one week will write about hyper-partisanship and Fox News and talk radio and complain about extremism. And then she will find nothing good to acknowledge in the Conservatives. This latest piece is classic Toynbee. Every Tory minister is attacked. They're all idiots or nasty or, you know, we know what she writes. It's just not helpful to journalism. And my particular bee in my bonnet at the moment, and full declaration, Nadine Dorris is a very, very good friend of mine, is, you know, the way particularly women journalists are covering her appointment as culture secretary. It just, you know, seems to be the case that, you know, these identity politics campaigners, they want more women, but whenever a Tory woman is appointed, they don't quite work. What they don't want more women, actually, in politics, they want more people like them. And I feel a longer article coming on, that we don't have time in this press review, but it's just the lazy stereotypes. Nadine Dorris, Polly Toynbee, is not the same as Priti Patel. They may be Tory women, but they think differently. You know, Nadine Dorris has a very pro-lockdown point of view. You know, she takes quite unorthodox views in various issues. I don't have an Andrea Leadsom moment, but she's more of a mother in many ways than a woman, or at least both. She, family, community really matter to her. She has a better understanding of her colleagues than 90% of her male counterparts. She laughs at them. They all want to be prime minister. I'll probably be told off by her for mentioning this, but when Dominic Cummings was downstairs working in Downing Street when Boris was upstairs, very ill with COVID, I think Dominic was quite happy with the situation because he was in charge. He didn't even have to get the rubber stamp. It was Nadine who rang the medical people and said, I think the prime minister is incredibly ill. She's not conventionally intellectual, but she's run a business. She writes best-selling books. She's incredibly close to the prime minister. We actually have a culture secretary who's probably going to be the most influential culture secretary because of her closeness to the prime minister for ages. But we just get lazy, terrible journalism. And I'm going to stop there because otherwise I will rant and rant and rant. But no, Polly Toynbee really is the worst of political journalism, I'm afraid.
So, Maggie, firstly, do you have a reflection on that? But also you've also picked a story on the reshuffle. But the point that Tim there made about how Tory women are covered?
Yes. I mean, there's such snootiness, isn't there? Such snobbiness. And it was also quite remarkable how, was it Wes Streeting made the point about Nadeem Zahawi, how on earth could he be education secretary when he'd been to a private school, forgetting that this was somebody who came here from, you know, war-torn Iraq and clearly, you know, has had the life of a great immigrant family. And it just can't bear it. Everything is reduced. It's like the whole debate about Emma Raducanu, you know, she's from Bromley, you know, can we just get over all this stuff? Anyway.
Went to a grammar school.
And went to a grammar school, selective grammar school. I know, terrible. Anyway, let's move on. So I've chosen Fraser Nelson's column in the Daily Telegraph today, where he once again asks about the future of Michael Gove, one of the most influential reformers in cabinet. And he says, is his move to housing the end of Gove or the moment he redefines Toryism forever? You know, we know headline writers exaggerate a bit, but he does ask the question, you know, was this a sort of sadistic demotion or actually, and I think we reflected on this earlier in the week, a sign that he really wants Gove's intellectual reforming skills to get to grips with housing and also levelling up whatever it is, and can he define it? He doesn't tell us which way he thinks Gove will go, but he says that, you know, if he can get to grips with this, and really, it, you know, it's not just about saying 300,000 houses a year, but talk to the house builders, look at how the housing market really operates, crack some of those monopolies we have, because we know that, 60% of the market is controlled by three house builders. You know, some really fundamental reforms are needed. Then maybe he can help put a few bombs under planning.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting piece.
Yeah, it's a really, really good piece. It's just going to be interesting to see, as we discussed earlier in the week on reaction, how much leeway Gove has and how radical or robust he's allowed to be, because it seems as though planning reform is shut down. He doesn't have any control unless he can arrange something with the Chancellor and with the Bank of England. Cheap money policy is going to continue, which is distorting the housing market and distorting demand. And is he going to be allowed to construct something like a sort of English housing corporation underpinned by the state? I have an open mind on it. I'm going to be really interested to see what he comes up with, because it's look at what's happening to.
Well, the obvious thing, Ian, is maybe launch a Competition and Markets Authority investigation into the house builders. You know, maybe.
Yes. I mean, that's something that Liam Halligan, the Telegraph and GB News has been suggesting very much ahead of the curve. So let's see what happens.
Can I suggest scrap Help to Buy, first of all? Stop inflating demand and focus on supply.
All the gimmicks, and / stamp duty. I mean, you read the piece by, you know, stamp duty is actually holding up the whole process of people downsizing. Why would you? We read Doug McBrillion's fantastic piece for us earlier this week. That was one of the main points. Anyway, we must do a session on housing one day.
Yeah, and if you're not a subscriber to Reaction on YouTube, you're watching Press Review with me, Ian Martin, Maggie Pagano and Tim Montgomery. It's the weekly show where we analyse the stories that have really grabbed us, that illuminate the big trends in media and politics and geopolitics and culture. So and just hit the subscribe button below. Just back on the reshuffle, just for one second. I had one. It wasn't a sort of major choice. I didn't want to discuss a very long piece by Gordon Brown. No, don't switch off. It's a really interesting piece by Gordon Brown in the New Statesman, and we have mentioned the New Statesman, I think, in all of the last three episodes. So I hope they're sponsoring us. I'm not going to labour the point. However, so much has happened in politics in the last 10 days, 2 weeks in the UK, that I just thought there was what the Brown piece, intentionally or unintentionally, illustrates the scale of the problem that faces Labour and just the dominance of Boris Johnson at the moment. See how long that lasts. Some people are predicting 10 years, but politics tends not to work out like that. But Gordon Brown has written a piece based on some really interesting polling, essentially, that he's done in his latest Save the Union incarnation. And the headline is "The Britain of Emma Raducanu Shows Why Nationalists Are Losing the Argument." So I'm just going to read the intro. It says, "A new Britain is waiting to be born. It is economically progressive, egalitarian on race, religion, sex and gender, culturally centrist on law and order, defence and our history and traditions. It has a far stronger sense of place, not only keen to celebrate our local as well as national identities, but insistent that local communities be empowered with the control and the resources to make levelling up a reality." Now, he might not see it this way, but he's describing the Conservative Party, as you said, Maggie, and that is a paragraph that could have been written by Boris Johnson.
Absolutely.
And it illustrates, I just think, how
Come, Ian. It's all jargon. What does it mean? Yes, it is the Conservative Party, but it's empowerment, all that sort of stuff. What? It's like a soundbite generator, put stuff, random things. I'm sorry, I don't find it interesting or insightful. Scott, but to you, Ian, but I've heard Gordon Brown say that 100 times before.
I do find it interesting because I think it is... It's one of the first examples I've seen of a big Labour figure, a grandee, actually attempting to grapple, whether you like the phrasing or not, with the realities of life after Brexit and the shifts there have been away from globalisation. I mean, this is, remember, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair for when they dominated... in the way that Boris now appears to dominate politics for now. When they dominated, their speeches were all about the inevitability of globalization, the way in which forces of technology, trade were going to mean that the nation state would still exist, but would sort of fade into the background, that this was going to be a hyper globalized world. This change couldn't be stopped. So Britain either had to adapt to this and go with it or be left behind in the great global race. So I think that was David Cameron's version of it. And of course, 2016 is a rejection of that. It's an attempt to rebalance, say, actually, no, that elite view of globalization is wrong. Globalization comes with all sorts of downsides as well as upsides. Let's have a course correction back towards nation, place, all the rest of it. Now, his phrase in Gordon Brown terms, but that's him admitting, recognizing. Maggie, tell me whether you agree or disagree, those new realities.
I haven't read the whole piece, Ian, but...
Well done, Maggie. I can read the end of it.
I'm not sure if I will after this, but no, of course I have a glance. I sort of agree a bit with both of you, actually, but...
Come off the fence, Jews!
It is easy to come up.
I'm going to be cut off, I think, in a minute. I'm a bit rowdy today.
I mean, if we want to get to the depths, what the pandemic and Brexit has shown us is the fragility of globalization. And, you know, not just the fragility, but the supply chain infrastructure, our own country, and of course, all the higher wages that we're seeing coming through, which was one of the big Brexit arguments. And it's very hard for the Labour Party now to argue against some of these higher wages. So I think they've got themselves in a bit of a pickle. It's an interesting...
There's a good column on all of that in the Times yesterday. I forget the guy who wrote it, but...
Can't think.
Thank you for mentioning that, Tim, but it is...
It was a good piece. If Gordon Brown was a bad representative of Scotland in his piece, I don't know why you're sucking up to him. I'm going to suck up to you, and yours was a really good piece, and... political obsessives like me were fascinated by the reshuffle, but I bet the average reader, this whole thing about rising wages for people who actually need their wages to rise, you wrote a much more relevant piece.
But I think in his way, Gordon Brown is essentially saying, you know, there's no way back for the centre-left in Britain, in England particularly, unless it recognises, voters are inherently patriotic and they quite... like the country. They might think that certain things need to be fixed in it. The country has all sorts of problems, but inherently they like it. It was really interesting, though, writing that piece about, and I wrote for the Times, about what seems to be happening in the labour market and pressure on wages and labour shortages. And the numbers are up in the air because of the pandemic. But it's just really illuminating to be challenged by some people who were ultra-Remainers at the time, who said, look, this freedom of movement actually, I mean, do you remember it was said, it really makes no difference to wages. It's not really a downward pressure on the low paid. Okay, fine, I sort of contest that, but the numbers are contested and there's an argument to have. But then now say, look, Brexit and the end of freedom of movement means labour shortages. And there seems to be in certain sectors like drivers and food processing, wage inflation. Well, which is it? And I think there's a really, I think, a cross-party conversation to have, which is that essentially Thatcherite labour market reforms, which I'm broadly in favour of, combined with EU free movement, created a business model in this country for 30, 40 years that is inherently dysfunctional. And people are worried about labour shortages. Certain companies, certain parts of big business just have to rethink. Some of that will be more investment in machinery, and some of it is paying the low paid more. Anyway, on that note, I think we're going to wrap up for the week, Maggie, but I think you had one more thing you wanted to mention, which is related to your choice from our last episode on Norway. And now we know what happened. You want to highlight a really interesting piece on what it means.
Yeah, absolutely. I just thought, as I mentioned it last week, I'll tell you the result. We haven't seen it, which is that the Labour Party did get the biggest party, so it can lead a coalition. But it still was the lowest vote, that it's second lowest vote that it's had since the 1920s. So whilst a lot of people have been saying this is a sort of shift to social democracy, social left back in Norway, it's not quite true. But there are nine parties, and the Arbeiderpartiet has to form a coalition with either with the centre party and the socialist left. Now, both those parties are inherently Eurosceptic, which is slightly different from here in the UK, because Norway, of course, is not part of the EU, but it is part of the economic, the European Economic Agreement. Have I got that right? Yeah.
EEA.
And of course, EFTA. Now, both these Eurosceptic parties have said that part of their condition for joining in coalition will be that they renegotiate with Brussels. They don't like all the power and they don't like the extent of the budget. But the Labour Party has said, no, absolutely not. They're very pro being part of the EEA. So it's going to be interesting to watch how those negotiations go.
We know what Michel Barnier thinks about.
Well, yes. We need to talk about him, actually, don't we? We really do.
In a future episode, I'm sure, well, the French election, there's going to be lots of opportunities to talk about that. I would just say, Maggie, to our Norwegian friends, if they are going to, after the experience as that Britain's had in negotiating with Brussels, if Norway's about to have a renegotiation with Brussels, all I can say is good luck.
Good luck, absolutely.
But Lisa May is available, though, if you want her help.
I think it's a lot of hot air, personally. I don't think they will.
Yeah,
we'll see. I think he'll probably have to pretend, the Prime Minister-to-be will pretend that he will try and tackle some of the inequalities.
Yeah. I think everyone in Europe has learnt that after the British experience, that negotiating with Brussels is not necessarily straightforward. But on that note, we're going to wrap up this episode of Press Review. I'm Ian Martin. I was joined by Tim Montgomery and Maggie Pagano from the Reaction team. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction on YouTube, hit the subscribe button below. Please like this video and also go to the site where you can get all of the journalism produced by the team. You also, if you become a member of Reaction, you get my weekly newsletter every Saturday morning, which is on politics, geopolitics, economics, culture, and all manner of other stuff. But until next time,
I just like to make a promise to our viewers. Please visit next week. I'm going to do everything to stop Ian Martin recommending another Gordon Brown article next week. It will be a safe space for you. Don't give up on us.
I'm being nice about Gordon Brown, but then
Save the union. It's very important.
I promise. Union. He's doing good work on saving the union, and I promise not to tell my
stories.
Tim.
In this mess.
I promised, that's a different argument for a different episode, but I promised not to tell my stories about having to edit Gordon Brown's incredibly long pieces, which he used to
I would be interested in that. That's
really... We'll save that for another episode.
The Reaction editors there, with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is the Reaction podcast. And until Friday, thank you for listening.